It's the final exam in Lostology. Ooh, we got to do a quick review because you got to get it. You ready? What's the definition of Lostology? Lostology is the study of being lost and what that experience can teach Christians about evangelism. That means that every time we get lost physically, we feel things or think things that give us insights into how spiritually lost people think and feel every time they are involved in a search for God. Now, two key verses help us in Lostology. Luke 19:10, "For the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost." Also, Matthew 18:14, "In the same way, your Father in heaven is unwilling that any of these little ones should be lost." Luke chapter 15 is the big chapter on Lostology. In that chapter, Jesus told three stories with the same punchline. Here's how it went. A shepherd had 100 sheep. One got lost, so the shepherd left the 99 in the fold to look for the one in the field. When he found the one in the field, he brought it back, called his friends together, and had a party to celebrate. A woman had 10 coins. She lost one, so she left 9 on the table to look for one on the floor. She looked all over the house, and when she found the one on the floor, she called her friends together and had a party to celebrate. A man had 2 sons. One was lost. The father did all he could do to find that son. He waited for him, and when the son came back, the father welcomed him, called his friends together, and had a party to celebrate. Who was the first and greatest lostologist? Jesus. How many laws of lostology? 24. The first 12 laws of lostology give us insights into how spiritually lost people think and feel. That's what we've done the last 2 days, is focus on those laws. What we're going to do today and tomorrow is to change gears, to shift out of understanding how spiritually lost people think and feel, and understand more about our part in God's search and rescue team. Now this morning, what I want to do is tell you 3 stories. I want to tell you about my wedding ring. I want to tell you about a search and rescue operation that we had to get involved in. Then I want to tell you about an event that happened on Mount Hood in Oregon. First, I want to tell you about my wedding ring. Now, I'm not going to actually tell you about this wedding ring. I'm going to tell you about this other wedding ring I used to have. Now, I'm married to the same woman, but I got a different wedding ring. Now, the problem with that wedding ring that's not here, the reason I can't tell you about it, is because it's lost. It's not technically lost because I know where it is. I mean, I know the state that it's in. Now, in fact, I can do better than that. I know the city that it's in. It is in West Lynn, Oregon. Any of my Oregon friends here? West Lynn. There you go. Okay, West Lynn, Oregon. In fact, I can narrow it down. It is in Willamette Park in West Lynn, Oregon. In fact, I know the corner of the park that it's in. You see, I know exactly where I was when I lost that ring. I was involved in a massive water balloon fight. Now, we were having this vacation Bible school deal with a whole bunch of kids, and frankly, I had just about had it with these kids. It's getting toward the end of the week. How many of y'all have worked with kids as a part of summer missions and other things? I mean, you get to the place where you just gonna have to let some steam out, and that's where I was. I mean, I was standing there being a pretty nice guy. People come up, popping you with water balloons, and finally, I just had it. You know, I just kind of snapped. And so I get up this big load of water balloons, and I'm just pulverizing little kids. I mean, I'm merciless. Going, kaboom, kaboom, kaboom. I mean, I'm just, you know, guy, how you like that? Boom, I'm getting them all over. And at some point in time, some kid not only got the big water balloon in the back of the head, he had a gold kink that followed it. The problem was, I didn't know that instantly because I was kind of into the moment. Got back to my office, sopping wet, looked down, missing my wedding ring. Now, let me give you a little background here. My wife and I, Lynn Marie, have been married quite a while now. And as she would say to you, I'm not really good with small objects. I mean, that's just kind of a life principle we've learned to accept. And so that was not the first time I'd lost that wedding ring. Now, Guys, can I see your hand if you think there is any chance that you're going to get married one day? I mean, just maybe an outside chance. You're thinking about it. Okay, let me just kind of clue you in. Wedding rings are a real big deal, so you need to pay attention to this. You know, I mean, I don't know what the deal is. There's this big emotional attachment to it. So, you know, the first time I lost this ring, I went in and said, "Hey, Lemarie, I've lost my wedding ring." And, you know, we kind of had a crisis there in the marriage. I mean, she was taking it a whole lot more serious. And part of the reason was she didn't think I was taking it serious enough, so I kind of clued in. I'm fast like that, so I figured it out, and I said, well, I'm going to have to do something. So on that particular occasion, I found the ring. I'd left it at the health club. It was in a bunch of towels and all that stuff. Well, I lost it again, you know, and went several days, and I was getting a little worried and setting up marriage counseling. And so, you know, then it was in the guest bedroom. I found it then. So this particular day, when I saw that ring was gone, I knew what to do. Now, guys, pay really close attention. Here's what you do. I left immediately. I mean, I didn't change clothes. I didn't do nothing. I went back to the park, and I looked around, and I got a big old stick, you know, kind of a poking stick, okay? And then I got this poking stick, and the problem out here was that because of this massive water balloon fight, the place was sopping wet and covered with debris of little colorful bits of water balloons. And so I'm going around with my poking stick. I mean, I am intent. I am going all over. Of course, we had had a wide-ranging water balloon fight, and so there was lots of territory. As I was going through, poking around, you know, the women would come up to me and they'd say, "Oh, did you lose something?" I said, "Yes, I lost my wedding ring." And they'd get this pained look on their face. Occasionally, a man would come up to me and say, "What's the matter?" I said, "Well, I lost my wedding ring." And he gave me one of these looks that said, "Your fat's in the fire now, buddy." I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of what the look, you know, I mean, it was just a guy thing. We were connecting at a deep level. So I looked and looked. I mean, I am intent with this poking stick. And so I'm going around. And finally, I quit. I mean, I can't find it. So I go home that night. And guys, pay attention here. I did the only thing you can do in that situation. I decided to give it a day. So the next day, I went back to the park again. I got me another poking stick, you know, and so I went out and poked around some more. And finally, I just acknowledged the fact that I couldn't find that ring. Okay. So I go back to Lemarie and I say, "Lemarie, there's a problem, and I want to tell you about it. That I have lost my wedding ring, but I want to tell you about what I've done to try to find it." And so then I told her about all these days of looking, the poking stick and all that stuff. And, you know, it was hard. I mean, it was shaky there, touch and go. And she said that the only thing that would ease her pain if we went right down then and got some more wedding rings. And so that's what we did. That's why I've got this one, you know, on now. So, guys, let me just tell you. It's a lot cheaper if you keep up with them, so learn that first. If you're going to lose them, you don't have to tell right off. Don't tell everything you know. Look around quite a while, because that seemed to help. At least it worked for me. Now, here's the principle of lostology that comes out of that. You ready? A search always reveals your values. A search always reveals your values. Let me give you a bit of marriage counseling on this side of it. What if I would have gone up to Lemarie and said, "Lemarie, I have lost my wedding ring." And I said, "I just feel awful about it." And she says, "Well, did you look for it?" And said, "No, I was really busy, but you know, I really care about that wedding ring a lot." What's the problem there? No search, no value. Big search, big value. Whatever search you do reveals the value in your heart. The more you value something that is lost, the greater you will express that value in action. How do we know that Jesus valued the lost? The Son of Man came to seek and to save those who are lost. What extreme did Jesus go to launch that search? What we see in Jesus' life is someone that was willing to launch an unlimited search to find those who were lost. As a result, when we see that, we begin to understand what should be true about us. Now, what that makes us do is to have to come in and reevaluate some things about our lives. You see, many times, those of us who have been around the church for a while, particularly those of us like me who find evangelism to be challenging and one of the more difficult things that we do as Christians, we hang around together, and those of us who aren't good in it, we begin to develop rationale for why we don't do it. Now, you probably haven't used any of these, but let me tell you some of the ones that I've used. You know, I found that if I would just tell people that evangelism is not my gift, which it isn't, that sometimes people will say, well, that's okay. I mean, you know, God hadn't gifted you for it. You don't have to do it, I don't guess. Or maybe I'd say something like, well, you know, I really don't have time, which is usually true. You all are busy. I mean, you're going to be busy all the, you know, rest of your lives. And so it's always going to be possible to say, well, I just don't have time. Well, there was a period of time when I was really good at saying, well, you know, I'd be glad to do evangelism, but I just don't know really any non-Christians, which is true. And then the best one, now see, if you want to get out of doing evangelism, here's what you do. You say, well, you know, I would really love to do that. I mean, no fooling. But really, what I need is just a little more training. And so you say, do you all have any training classes at your church or your BSU or your campus, whatever? Say, yeah, we got training. I say, oh, good. I'm willing to do it, but I'd like to do some training first. And so, you know, we sit down and we get involved in some training and we stay there about 17 years, you know, and we're just getting more training. I'm just going to work it up until finally we begin to really have it. And one day I looked at this thing and I began to say, you know, there's something wrong here. Because I looked at my life and I have been trained beyond anything that's possible. I've been through CWT, EE, I've been trained in stuff in college, I've been to seminary, I can do all kinds of classes, I know the theology of evangelism, I know all this stuff. And so all of a sudden I began to think, you know, we may not have reasons here for not doing evangelism, we might be bumping into excuses. And suddenly the Lord broke my heart and I had to ask this very difficult question. I said, is it possible that what I have is a lack of value for people who are spiritually lost? Is it possible that what is in my heart for people that don't know Christ is not the same as what was in God's heart? You know, friends, if God begins to change our value system related to what it's like to be lost, a lot of this business about sharing our faith begins to fall into line. You see, if you value something deeply and it concerns you deeply that it's missing, you don't have to sit around and orchestrate what you're going to do. Action flows naturally out of that. Sure, it would be great to be trained. Sure, it would be great to have more time. Sure, it would be great to do this and that. But if the value is there, action is going to follow. So let me just ask you this. As you look at your life right now, what level of intensity is your search spiritually? Are you down here at the pretty low level, you know, not much happening in there? Or are you moving up a little further? Just remember, down here, up here, a search always reveals your values. And if you don't like where you are, here's what you need to pray. Oh God, break my heart with the things that break your heart. What do we do if somebody is missing? You know, some of you will raise your hands. You've worked with kids and stuff where you've been responsible. How many have been responsible for groups of kids? Like you take them somewhere? You know, that's a big deal. I mean, that kind of weight of responsibility. And so those of us who have done that realize that you've got to be careful because sometimes those little guys get lost. I mean, have you ever been with a group that you were in charge of and somebody got lost? Can I see your hand? Whoa, I mean, that freaks you out. And so, you know, what I've learned over the years is that I always try to be prepared for that. And maybe I can give you some help here. The first thing that I ask if somebody gets lost is I immediately want to find out, is there any help available? And I'd preferably like to get that help at the cheapest price. So what I do every time I'm someplace is I get the yellow pages for that city, and I go back, because what I really want to find is a discount search and rescue company. Yeah, do y'all do that? Well, I picked up, this is kind of a beat up one, but this is the Santa Fe yellow pages, and so I was going through this, and you can go back here, check it out later, back under, okay, we got sewers, okay, oh, search and rescue. Now, let me just read you some of the ads that are here and see if some of these might be what you would use if you had to find some place. Okay, here we go, here in Santa Fe. Honest Herbs Handy Searches. You lose them, we find them. Best prices in town, your hometown search store. Now, Honest Herbs sounds pretty good. Now, there's also Lottie's Cut Rate Lost and Found. 17 years of experience. Custom searches by caring professionals. You can't find what you've lost for less. That sound pretty good? That's a good one right there. Now, this is good. This is kind of a techno kind of place. Search Facts. Don't let a search interrupt your busy schedule. Leave the searching to us. Fax the information. We'll keep you posted. All major credit cards accepted. That's a good one. Now, I like this one. This is one you don't see every place. This is called Sniff and Scent Incorporated. Trained search chihuahuas. Top searches in tight places. Rent our dogs by the hour or by the day. Easy pickup and drop off. All dogs housebroken. That's very important right there. Now, the last one here in Santa Fe is the place called Lost Line International. Call 1-900-GET-LOST. Says, why pay for high-priced searchers when our trained telephone professionals can help you organize your search over the phone? Just $2.75 per minute, hundreds less than you spend on a traditional search. And then they close by saying, for updates on our worldwide search for Elvis, ask for operator 146. Now, have you all checked the yellow pages for discount search and rescue groups in your city? Guess what? They don't exist. You can't even find the category because there is no such thing as a discount search. You see, when somebody is lost, you don't first say, wow, this is really inconvenient. I think I won't do this right now. You don't say, oh my, this might cost me some energy. I was planning on relaxing. I don't think I'll search. You don't say, this might cost me some money. I'm sorry, I'm not going to do that. I mean, we look at that. If someone is missing, everything changes. We don't put it on a cost analysis basis. We say, well, you know, I wonder what it'd run me to find that little guy that's missing. And yet, as absurd as that is, how many of you have been in a church business meeting lately? When the budget comes down and we look at our plans for the next year and decide what we're willing to spend on the search and rescue operation of that church, and people go, well, I don't know, if we do that, we might not be able to get the place for the fellowship hall. Have you been in a campus meeting when you're deciding what you're going to do to try to impact your campus for Christ, and someone goes, well, you know, I'm really, really busy right now. I mean, we've got all this stuff going. It's pretty intense. You know, you got to get good grades, get a good job, all this stuff. I don't really know that I've got time for that. Let me tell you what, friends. A search is always going to be costly. How do we know? We look at Jesus once again. We look at His life and we realize from His life and from the stories He told, a search is always costly. Think about that shepherd. 100 sheep, one was missing. The man had to make a decision. Was it going to cost him time to go look for that one lost sheep? Yeah. Was it going to cost him some energy? Yes. Could it cost him some money? Probably. Had to get some help. And so what we see is in his example, there was a cost involved, but the supreme cost is what we see in Jesus' life. Aren't you glad that when Jesus found that you were lost and that somebody needed to search for you, He didn't turn to the yellow pages for the search firm? Aren't you glad that Jesus said, I will pay whatever it costs? Several years ago, I learned about this in a whole new way. In 1987, I really felt the call of God on my life to leave where we were serving in the Dallas area as associate pastor of a church there. And we were having a great time. It was good ministry, but I really wanted to be involved in a setting where there would be more secular people in the community. Maybe not as much of a church presence, not as much of a witness. And so I really felt God calling me to go way, way out of my comfort zone and go and start a church. And that's what led me and my wife to move to a suburb of Portland to begin a new work. We worked almost all of 1987 there in Dallas, just doing the preparation work. It was kind of funny how we got into this thing. Of course, I didn't know anything about beginning a new church. I didn't know what to do. As I've told you, I'm not particularly good at evangelism, so I was open to anything we could do to help get our church started. Those of you that don't know about the Northwest don't realize that it's really tough. It's a lot different than being like in Texas or some of these other places where I was used to. I mean, most of the churches are very small. The work is very hard. People are very nice as far as people in the community, but they're definitely not interested in God very much. So we didn't know what to do. Well, about that time, I got a little flyer from a guy named Norm Juan. Now, Norm is an interesting study in and of himself. Norm became a Christian in his 50s. He had been the head of a telemarketing firm and had made a gazillion dollars but was a pagan. And he came to Christ through the Quakers, through the Friends Church. And he became a sold-out Christian. And Norm began to watch how the Quakers were starting their churches. And he said, man, this is not very good, I don't think. He said, what if we try to start a church using telemarketing? And people just kind of go, tell me no. I mean, telemarketing for Jesus, I don't think so. But Norm didn't know any better, so he said, listen, I can get you people to come to a first service. Now, I can't guarantee it's going to be any good once they get there, but I tell you what, I've got some ideas about how we can do it. Well, Norm put this whole deal together, and basically he had a plan where you could do a bunch of telemarketing phone calls to find people who would be interested, and then that would lead up to having your first service. So, again, I'm just stupid as dirt on this stuff, so I didn't know what to do. So I come in, I said, that's what we're going to do. That's what we're going to do. So, beginning in late 1987 and early in 1988, we put together this plan, and this is the twist that we had. I went to my church in Garland, which was a pretty large church, and I said, wouldn't you all just love to be telemarketers for Jesus? You know, and boy, just the excitement welled up in their hearts. People just said, yes, oh yes. No, that's not exactly what they did, but they were willing to do it. And so what that church did is do a telemarketing campaign from Garland, Texas to Portland, Oregon. Here's what happened. We gave all the people, that Sunday afternoon in January 1988, we had sheets of paper, crisscross directory, and list everybody's names street by street in all the area we were going into. We had 100 names per page. And out here in the audience, we had all the grandmas and grandpas, the young people, the middle-aged people. We had all the folks out here, and we gave everybody a sheet of paper. We had a little script, and you know, they were going to call up people and say, hi, I'm with the new Westside Baptist Church, going to be starting in your area in April. And what we do, we're just calling a few people to let them know what's going on. Are you and your family involved in church? If they said no, we said, great, we'd love to add you to our list and send you some information. Now, that group of people in Garland made 42,000 long-distance phone calls and paid their own phone bills. 42,000 people. Now, to top that, people in the Northwest, remember, these are little churches for the most part in the Northwest. They didn't have a lot of resources to give, but they joined the search. And so people from the Northwest said, we'll help in this. And so people there in those churches that weren't going to be a part of our thing said, we will help too. And they made an additional 5,000 phone calls. Okay, here you got it. So 47,000 phone calls have gone out into this community looking for people that said, we're not involved in a church and we wouldn't mind hearing about one that's starting up. Out of that, we had 3,800 people that were added to our list that we then sent 6 mailings to telling them about what we're going to do. You know, you talk about vaporware. I mean, this church didn't even exist yet, so we're pumping up how great it's going to be, you know, how they ought to come. I mean, whew, it's going to be wild, but we're telling them about it. Then the week before our very first service in March, We called back every one of those 3,800 people and reminded them that our church was starting that following Sunday. Now, let me just stop here for a minute. How many think that sounds like a big old bunch of time and energy? How many think that that costs those folks making the phone calls, both in the Northwest and in Texas, a bunch of bucks? Yes. How many think it cost a lot of money to send out those mailings to do all these things? Yes, it did. For more than a year, a whole bunch of us gave every ounce of our energy to getting this search and rescue operation launched. So March the 13th, 1988, we come in to the Lake Oswego High School auditorium, and we've got set up. How many chairs would you set up? You know, what do you know? I mean, who knows what's going to be there? So we come in and we set up, and people from our church in Garland had come to help us. We didn't have any people to do anything, you know, take care of the babies, pass the offering, all that stuff. So we set up chairs and we wait. And that morning, people began to come. And before the day was over, 209 people had showed up for the very first service. I want to tell you how I felt that morning. I'd given so much energy to this that I was sort of feeling exhausted and numb. By the standards of the Northwest, that was an incredible thing, to have that many people come. I mean, the people, my friends in the Northwest, were just going, this is unbelievable. And really, after I was there a while, I realized it was a miracle. Let me tell you what I was thinking. I just looked out that morning, and I didn't know these people. I mean, just, you know, 200 folks sitting out here. And I'm thinking, man, so much work. And this is what we got. This is it. I mean, so much work. And I know it wasn't right, but that's what I was thinking. I was saying, you know, is it really worth this much to get these people? But you know what began to happen over the next weeks? I began to know those people. And I began to hear their stories about how God led them here. It was so funny. I had this one fellow that came to me. I said, John, tell me why you came, bud. And he said, well, I was just sitting at home watching TV, and man, I got this call from this Southern Belle, and she sounded real cute, so I came to church to see her. He was really disappointed. Talked to another lady who was there with her daughter, and she wrote on her card that morning, it's really tough right now. My husband's left, and I don't know what to do, and we got your call, and we just came. You know, what I had started doing that morning is kind of a cost analysis, looking at the time and energy spent versus the number of people reached. And that's really sick. Because what happened is that I began to see a whole different thing, realizing it doesn't matter the cost expended in time, energy, whatever. What mattered is that we launched a search and we found some people. And you know what? There were a lot of people, thousands of people that didn't get found. There were lots of places we looked where we didn't find people. But you know what? None of that mattered to the people that were there that morning. In fact, they absolutely flipped out when we began to share with them the search that was launched to find them. They could not believe it. You see, friends, if you're going to be involved in God's search and rescue operation, it's always going to be hard. It's always going to cost you time and energy and money. But that's the way it is. The last thing I want to tell you about a true story. I want to tell you about something that happened on Mount Hood. Mount Hood is the peak that kind of sits over and guards the whole Portland area. We love in Portland to look out and see Mount Hood, a 10,000 foot peak, and just to look out there and see it. Well, it's an amazing place, and there's a lot of people that ski up there and like to hike up there. But in March of 1986, excuse me, in May of 1986, 12 hikers got involved trying to make it up to the top of the peak. Now, this was a group from a private high school in Portland. There were 3 adults and 9 high school students, and they left the Timberline Lodge, which is right up there close to the peak, but still a long way from the summit. The weather up there that day was questionable. Now, when you hike to the summit, you start for some reason at 2 or 3 in the morning, so they were watching the weather patterns, and this has been this big trip these kids had planned and looked forward to. And so the weather looked like maybe it was going to get bad, but then it seemed to clear off and all the forecasts gave a green light. And so the group and the sponsors, the three adults that were with the kids, made the decision to head up toward the peak. So they left about 2 o'clock that morning from Timberline Lodge. As they got up toward the peak, the weather systems changed, as they can do rapidly in the northwest. They converged and kind of enfolded right on top of Mount Hood. The temperature dropped below freezing. Snow, ice, blowing winds. It was absolutely a horrible situation. The people involved in that little crew, the three leaders and the nine kids, began desperately trying to retrace their steps and get back to Timberline Lodge, but it was going very poorly. Some of the young people began to experience hypothermia, and so the leaders made the decision they just weren't going to make it down that way. So they decided in a desperate attempt what they would do. They built an ice cave, they tunneled out of the ice, they did the best they could to shelter who was going to be there, and then three people, a couple of the leaders and one kid, went down to try to make it down to the lodge to send help. Well, by this time, this storm had absolutely engulfed the mountain. I mean, it was a horrible storm. Miraculously, these three people made it down to the lodge, let the people know what was going on, and searchers went to the peak, beginning a massive search effort. Now, that storm didn't let up for 3 days. These searchers had to put their lives on the line in order to try to find those people. They searched desperately. Now, why was there such urgency? You see, they understood if they didn't find those people quickly, they were going to die. And so the searchers set aside their own needs, preferences, desires. They put their lives on the line to search for the lost. 3 days later, they finally found the ice cave, and only one student was still alive. The principle of lostology is this: a search is urgent because the lost are in danger. A search is urgent because the lost are in danger. Jesus has told us this. We see it in His life. Why was He so purposeful and forthright in what He did? Because Jesus understood that eternity hangs in the balance. Jesus understood that if we don't find the lost, they will be separated from God. Yes, friends, that is hard to take in sometimes. Yes, it is uncomfortable, but yes, it is true. And a search is urgent because the lost are in danger. Let me ask you this. How much has that sense of urgency entered your life? How concerned are you for your spiritually lost friends? We're going to stop here as we close out this morning and watch a really short video. This is an actual newscast, and I want to come back and talk to you just for a bit more.
Deborah Gianola. Meteorologist George Wendling with weather. Sam Tavares with sports. And the area's most watched news team.
Hello, everybody. One of the most extensive searches ever in St. John's County paid off today. 18-month-old Jonathan Kelly has been found safe after being lost overnight in the woods north of St. Augustine. Eyewitness News reporter Mike Maychek was there when the toddler was reunited with his family.
How you doing, baby? Good day. Mommy's coming. Mommy's coming.
Some have called it nothing less than a miracle. For the better part of yesterday, through the night and this morning, Jonathan Kelly was a lost boy, wandering through a strange territory, exposed to the elements, wearing nothing more than a diaper.
Him being without nothing to drink, eat, nothing but a diaper on all night. With all the snakes and everybody tried so hard.
Late this morning, little Jonathan, slightly dehydrated and covered with mosquito bites, was found. 3/4 of a mile from where he left.
He just cried out. He was in some bramble bushes, and I called his name, and he cried out again. And, you know, it's just Get me the heck out of here.
This child has been very fortunate. He's been somewhere cool, and it's been able to keep him alive.
Jonathan had wandered off in the woods, miles from his home, at a relative's trailer, an unfamiliar place. His mother left him there with his two brothers while she ran some errands.
People at the sheriff's office say Jonathan was last seen playing in a sandbox within a fenced-in yard. They say he was left unattended by a babysitter for just a few minutes, enough time to wander off.
It's speculated Jonathan made his way through an opening in the fence. This isn't the first time the child has wandered off, but before, it's been at his own home.
He's left our yard at home, but it's been home, and he knew he was born in Annie's house right next door. You know, it's not like he took off down the road.
Jonathan! Mom, let's go home!
The search for Jonathan started out small, but when word of the lost boy spread, volunteers by the dozen poured in to help find him. In helicopters, on horseback. Two nearby ponds were drained out of fear the boy may have fallen in and drowned. Even an army plane with a heat-sensitive and infrared device was brought in overnight to search the area.
Unfortunately, the plane didn't spot the child, but that's neither here nor there. What's important here is that we got the effort on it.
What's important to Jonathan's parents is that because of the unselfish help and virtuous strangers, their son is home safe tonight. Mike Machak, Channel 4, Eyewitness News.
I'd like for you to bow your heads, if you would, please. Here is the truth spiritually. There are people lost all around us. The appeal has gone out because the lost are in danger. We are the search team. What are we going to do? This morning, I'd like to challenge some of you to begin to make a commitment to something that you've sensed God doing in your life. Maybe it's been over the last weeks and months. Maybe it's been something that happened just this week. But you've sensed that God is calling you in a special and unique way to be part of God's search and rescue team. Maybe God's calling you to give your life to search and rescue operations overseas. Maybe God's challenging you to become a full-time worker in a church vocation, as a pastor, a student minister, whatever. God is working to do something in and through you in that way. This is not going to be a time where we're asking people to come to the front. Tomorrow, I'm going to give you a challenge for all of us together to be a special part of God's search and rescue team. But I felt impressed today to ask, is God working in anyone here today, calling you either to the search and rescue work internationally as a missionary or as a student minister, a pastor, a minister in music, some other kind of vocational work? If so, nobody's looking around. I'm not going to call it. I would just like to see your hand. If you say, I'm really struggling with that, I sense God may be doing that with me.